You're listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast from Judicial Watch.
I'm Chris Farrell, and this is On Watch. Welcome to On Watch, everybody, the Judicial Watch podcast, where we go behind the headlines to cover news stories that the mainstream media would rather you not know about, where we try to recover some lost history, and where we try to explain the inexplicable. Thank you for taking time to join us. We appreciate it, whether you're following us in the video version of this podcast or the audio version. First of all, thank you for taking the time to follow us. Be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It's very helpful. Also, let us know what you want us to cover, who you'd like us to interview, and what topics you think are of interest for our coverage. Once again, thanks for joining us. Today, we have a great privilege of having KT McFarland join us on Watch. KT, as you know, is a former deputy national security advisor to the Trump administration and also served in a variety of national security and defense positions in the Nixon, Ford, and Reagan administrations as well. So she comes to us with an incredible portfolio of experiences. Welcome, KT McFarland.
Well, it's an honor and it's a pleasure. And before everybody starts trying to do the math, I started working for Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon right after my 18th birthday. So when I was a freshman in college. So in fact, I'm not really 100 years old, but I am old.
The amazing thing is that, at that young age, to be dropped into the middle of the Nixon administration working for Mr. Kissinger, talk about an eye-opening experience for a very young person.
Yeah, it was just a total fluke and an accident, but it really shaped the parameters of my entire life.
Right.
Because I started working as a freshman in college. I was a typist. I had to pay for college. I went to GW and started typing every night the president's daily brief that Henry Kissinger would deliver to Richard Nixon the first thing the next morning. And I didn't, I came from a background where people didn't go to college and I wasn't really familiar with the world. So I didn't know enough to be scared and impressed and terrified. So it started by working for Kissinger at a very exciting time. I mean, American foreign policy went through a number of events around the world. And they were all interrelated, but we got out of the Vietnam War.
Sure.
We had arms control agreements with the Soviet Union for the first time in decades. We had an opening to China, which was a good thing to do at the time, maybe in retrospect, not so good to do forever. And then there were historic peace agreements in the Middle East. And I was really right in the room when all of that was happening. So it was a real education on the job for me. And then I continued. Henry Kissinger was started as my boss, and then he became a mentor for 40, 50 years, and then he became a friend. And I went to graduate school at Oxford, MIT, came back and worked in the Reagan administration, then went on to have a career at Fox News as the national security analyst. And then President Trump tapped me to be the deputy national security advisor.
That is an incredible resume. What a wealth of amazing experiences. And I think one of the things that I was in doing preparation for the show, I read that you actually had a hand in writing President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative speech. Mm-hmm. And Ted Kennedy is the inventor of the expression Star Wars. And he did it in a pejorative manner to try to trivialize and make fun of what was really an amazing effort that ultimately broke the back of the Soviet Union. But just give us a little insight in your experience, writing or contributing to President Reagan's SDI speech. What was that like? What did you
cover? Okay, well, I was the chief speechwriter and deputy assistant secretary at the Pentagon at the time. So President Reagan had said that in March 1983, he wanted to give a speech talking about the Reagan defense buildup and the need to stay the course. So because I was at the Pentagon, I was a speechwriter, I drafted the first draft. It was a pretty good draft, if I say so myself. And so they used my draft, they used my words. And then President Reagan, on his own initiative, decided, this is the moment that I think we're going to talk to the American people and give them hope and talk about making a defensive shield against nuclear weapons so that we wouldn't have to forever after be in this terrible, chair trigger world where we kept the peace by holding a nuclear gun at each other's head. So he gave the Star Wars speech. And what he said in the speech was, look, we don't have the technology now, but I challenge the American scientific community to come up with something that can defend us against incoming Soviet missiles or incoming anybody missiles. And that would make a world that would be free of nuclear weapons. And so because I wrote the draft at the time, you know, if you were the author of the speech, you got to stay in the room while the president delivered it. So I was in the Oval Office when he delivered the speech.
That's great.
And afterwards, he invited a couple of these key scientists. There really were more than about 30 people, and me again, because I wrote the speech. And we went into the White House, not in the Oval Office, but into the East Room. And he said, look, to the scientists, he said, I'm challenging you to do this. We don't have, you know, tell me how it's going to work. And there were all these, there were a couple of Nobel laureates, there were a couple of generals, World War II veterans, and they were all kind of talking to each other. They all knew of each other, but they didn't necessarily know each other. And they all started talking. And one guy said, well, you know, I know about miniaturization and computers. I think we could do this. And another guy said, well, I know about lifting satellites into space. I think we could do it. And, you know, to watch these geniuses, a couple of whom had been my MIT professors and who had been working on the original Manhattan Project, to watch them sort of think through in their own heads how they could construct such a, you know, such a defensive shield for the United States. Now, at the time, we didn't have the technology to do it, but we had a lot of key elements of it. But the Soviet leaders, who had already been stretched to the breaking point, their economy was in shambles, their oil exports, the price of oil had gone way down, so they were broke. They looked at that speech and Reagan's remarks, and they said, look, we don't know if the Americans can do it, but we know we can't.
Right.
And we have no resources to throw at this. So that was probably the turning point. And in retrospect, a lot of the senior Soviet leaders had pointed to that speech and said that was the point at which they knew, we better end this Cold War. We better end it on America's terms. Now, what happened the next day was the New York Post had a headline, Reagan's plan to zap red nukes, Star Wars. And people made fun of it to say, well, this is, you know, this is crazy. This is like Star Wars. It's never going to happen. And so at the time, my colleagues at the Pentagon, including my boss, the Secretary of Defense, and the National Security Advisor, they said, oh, this is terrible. We have to keep calling it the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. And I said, are you guys crazy? Star Wars was the most important movie series at the time. It's back again, of course, but in the 1980s. And Star Wars was about this ragtag, good guys. They went up against the evil empire and they won. And I said, what a fabulous way of talking about what we want to do. We want to go up against the evil empire and win. So I always thought it was best called Star Wars. I'm delighted to see it still is called Star Wars.
That is a fascinating story. And, you know, I think the genius of Reagan was knowing enough to get all these smart guys and put them in the room together, right?
Yeah.
He didn't know what the answer was, but he knew that if he got the right people together and just let them kind of have a little synergy there, surprise, surprise, they probably would, as you said, probably would come up with some bright ideas to kind of at least get the thinking going in the right direction, even if they didn't have a flat answer. What's interesting is there's a scholar, Paul Kengor, K-E-N-G-O-R. Paul is up at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He wrote a very fascinating book that our viewers and listeners can go look up and get a copy of called Dupes, D-U-P-E-S. And Dupes talks about all the people that were sort of used and manipulated by the Soviets, and whether they were well-meaning or not, they were used in a sense. And that goes back to what you were just saying about Star Wars. Ted Kennedy was essentially recruited to come up with some kind of a snide remark to counter or to try to deflate the whole SDI initiative. And he is reported, at least Kengor says, that he is reported to have coined the term on the Senate floor in an attempt to mock it. And like you said, it actually boomeranged back and it became a common term that people kind of said, oh, I get it now. We're going to shoot stuff down from space. But it's interesting that Kennedy was actually doing that in a concerted effort, because Kengor has a lot of documentation about Kennedy's outreach to the Soviets and his offers to Andropov and others to essentially work for them. It's quite startling what Teddy Kennedy, the lengths he was willing to go to defeat anything that Reagan was offering as a defensive solution. I'd like to drag us forward into the not-so-distant past. And your role as Deputy National Security Advisor for the Trump administration, you know, when you look, given your experience and the time you've had in government, when you look at someone like Jake Sullivan as the current National Security Advisor, in my opinion, I can't think of a less qualified person to hold that position. It's really astounding that somehow Jake Sullivan has worked his way into this position. You've been with people like Henry Kissinger and General Mike Flynn. How does Jake Sullivan stack up?
Well, I think he's the national security advisor President Biden wants. And that's a guy who is part of the bureaucracy. He's a product of the bureaucracy in the globalist think tank world. And he's carrying out the job and the policies that President Biden and that whole group of people think are the right policies. And it really is the Obama administration. It's really the third term of the Obama administration. It's all
exactly.
And it's all the same approaches, whether it's to Iran, to placate and appease Iran, hoping that Iran will be good guys and responsible stakeholders. It's looking to China and not standing up to China, saying, well, China's a competitor, but not looking at China and say there's an adversary who's out to, famously, as Joe Biden said, China doesn't want to eat our lunch. Well, actually, they do want to eat your lunch. They want to eat your breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Right.
And it's to look at that. And then to look at the former Soviet Union, now Russia, and they look at Europe. And I think they have their solution to everything is to grab a gun, right? It's to let's go to war. And when I look back at President Reagan, and I also look at President Trump, their instincts were, well, let's not grab that gun. Let's see if we can prevent the war. Let's see if we can deter adversaries from coming after us.
Right.
And let's use what we're really good at. And what America's really good at is two things. It's our technology, our creative genius, and it's our strong economy. And so that's effectively how Reagan won the Cold War, bankrupted the Soviet Union. And that's how President Trump looked at looked at Russia, looked at China, looked at Iran, bankrupt the bad guys. And you don't have to go to war because you defeat them because they can't go to war. And here, and it sounds very simplistic, but there's a lot to unpack here. So in the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union were in an arms race. The Soviet Union had expanded around the world, and they were throwing their weight around. And the United States was not. I mean, we had let our military atrophy after Vietnam. Our standing in the world was in question. Our economy wasn't doing great at all. And so what President Reagan did was he set out to sort of go in about five different directions at once, but all of which would stress the Soviet Union's economy. So we closed the Soviet Union out of the world banking system, which meant they couldn't buy stuff. They couldn't get loans. Number two, we stopped all the advanced technology that had been going indirectly or even directly to the Soviet Union from the United States. We shut that down. The other thing is we improved our relations with our European and our Asian allies, and so they stood strong with us. But the final thing was that when President Reagan launched the Star Wars initiative, it was all primed and ready to go because Reagan understood that the Soviet Union would be rich as long as they could export oil at high prices. And if throughout the Soviet Union and now Russian history, every time oil prices have been high, the Russians have predictably done three things. They've rebuilt their military, they've invaded their neighbors, and they've had proxy wars around the world. When oil prices are low, that means they can't make any foreign currency. They can't make any money. Who buys anything that Russia makes, right? Nobody. You want to buy a Russian car? You want to buy a Russian, wristwatch? No. Russia sells oil and natural gas, but mostly oil, on the international market. That's where it makes its money. So if you can drive the price of oil down, the Russians they've got to stay home to try to feed their people. They may want to go to war with everybody, but they don't have the resources to do it. So ultimately, that was how Reagan won the Cold War. And I think that you could do the same thing again. The situation is slightly different, but you bankrupt the bad guys, whether you bankrupt Russia versus in the Ukraine war, you bankrupt Iran in the Middle East, and you can convince China that they need to buy American energy. Now, how do you do all that? It's just so simple. That's what's so frustrating. It's so simple. You just unleash American energy because we found in the last 10 or 15 years that we have the ability to get oil and gas, natural gas, out of rocks, effectively. It's called fracking. And it turns out we have the best rocks of anybody in the world. Now, we know how to do that for a long time. We just didn't know how to do it efficiently, safely, and cheaply. But we have figured out, our scientists, engineers have figured out how to do it safely and cheaply. We now have enough energy to power the world for 200 or 300 years, just using American oil and natural gas. And there's a number of things that happen that's really good if we use American natural gas and oil. First of all, we're not just energy independent. We don't have to rely on other guys and bad guys for our energy. We become energy dominant, which means we control the world energy market, we set the price, and our companies make money if oil is $40 or $50 a barrel. Russia, Iran, they need oil at double that because their oil revenues pay for everything else. So if the United States, and we did under President Trump, take the handcuffs off the American energy industry, prices go down, simple supply and demand. Russia doesn't have any extra money to go to war. Iran doesn't have any extra money to go to war. Our economy is booming. And at the same time, we go to the Europeans and our other allies who are energy needy, and we say to them, look, we will supply you oil and natural gas, particularly natural gas, LNG. It's going to be cheap, abundant, secure. You don't have to worry about it. It's going to be safe. But get off of the Middle East oil and natural gas, and particularly get off of Russia, because those countries use it to blackmail the world.
Everything you've just said is the exact polar opposite of what the Biden administration is pursuing around the world. It is literally diametrically opposed to the reality of their policies and what they're trying to institute. And so in the case of Russia, we can look at the Ukraine war and we can say, look, we've now driven Russia into the hands of or into the arms of China. And the two of them are very happy with their sort of symbiotic relationship. Oil's at an all-time high. Russia's making money hand over fist, selling oil, even discounted oil, selling to China. They're very happy with the relationship that they have together. We have crazy situations where Ukraine is actually suing Russia, and in mediation in Sweden to continue having Russia pump natural gas through Ukraine out to Eastern Europe. I mean, this is the level of weirdness. In the middle of a war, Ukraine is still very busy trying to get natural gas from Russia. So it's a very unhealthy, it's a really sick environment that the Biden administration has created. What do you see, or what's sort of your crystal ball? It's a tough crystal ball guess, but how does Ukraine end? Where are we going? What's the Biden administration's brilliant solution for ending the proxy war that we're involved in Ukraine?
They don't have a final solution. Their whole thing is, let's keep giving, keep supporting Ukraine, keep, $100 billion is probably what we've given to Ukraine so far. But over the last, years that we have been supporting Ukraine, the best they've managed is a stalemate. Or a war of attrition. And who wins a war of attrition? The country's richer and bigger and with more guys to be as soldiers.
Right.
So Ukraine doesn't win this war. That's why I think that the better solution would be, all right, if we can't get Ukraine, we don't want to leave Ukraine to the hands of the Russians, for sure. But if all we're going to get with all these efforts, which in some cases come at the expense of our own military readiness, is there's got to be another answer here. And what's the other answer? Well, the other answer is to use the economic weapon. So to do as I say, as I've suggested, so that if the United States, drill, baby, drill, Donald Trump says he's going to do it on day one, drill, baby, drill, that will bankrupt Russia. They will not be able to pursue the war. Now, what happens then? Well, Donald Trump has said, and it sounds simple, but it actually is pretty brilliant. He said, well, on day one, I'm going to close the border, drill, baby, drill, and then I'm going to get on the phone, and I'm going to call Vladimir Putin, and I'm going to say, unless you go to the negotiating table, I'm going to give Ukraine offensive weapons. It's going to be tough for you. And then he's going to get on the phone and he's going to call Zelensky and he's going to say, unless you go to the negotiating table, I'm not going to give you any weapons.
Right, right.
And so he's going to force both to the negotiating table. And then you get some kind of a deal. Who knows what that deal looks like? That's one part of the answer, though, because that real part of the answer is what Donald Trump did at the beginning of day one, drill, baby, drill.
Right.
So let's fast forward. If the killing stops, the war is over, where is the world 5 years after the war is over? Well, the West is going to put $1 trillion into Ukraine to rebuild it. It's resource rich, agricultural resources.
Right.
It's a well-educated population. The West is going to just stampede into invest in Ukraine. So within a couple of years, Ukraine will be fully integrated into the Western economies. Meanwhile, 5 years after the killing stops, where's Russia? Bankrupt? No friends. Nobody's going to rush in to invest in Russia. I mean, Russia's only friend is going to be China, which will probably, go after Russia's natural resources in the Eastern Siberian area. So the way you win this war is not on a battlefield. And the thing that I find so frustrating is that all the critics of a negotiated solution, they say, well, Putin can't be allowed to succeed. I mean, we can't reward him. No, you can't reward him. But how are you going to beat him? And there's no way Ukraine wins the war. None of these people are saying Ukraine is going to win the war and, I guess, topple Vladimir Putin. They know they can't do that.
Of course.
But Ukraine can win the peace.
Yep.
We should be playing the long game, as Reagan did, as Trump wanted to do, and Trump will do again, which is bankrupt Russia, and then they can't get in any trouble.
Right, right. That's a very interesting and, I think, very insightful assessment. In Israel, of course, we're now just over 6 months after this insanely, savagely brutal attack on Israel by Hamas. And, you know, Joe Biden appears to be a Hamas cheerleader, right? He's out there doing whatever he can, whether it's trying to impose pressure on our Israeli friends or whether he's subsidizing and financing and, you know, doing all sorts of bizarre gestures to uphold and support Hamas, you know, masquerading as Gazan relief, but it's really Hamas relief is what it really amounts to be. And then when you walk that back a step further, you end up in Iran, right? Everyone realizes the proxy connections there. So, you know, I guess the solution again, kind of following your line of thought, is pressure on Iran brings Hamas to heel, which relieves Israel. That's sort of the shorthand version, if I'm getting
and
your analysis
right. That's what we were
doing
in the Trump administration. We understood, again, with fracking, that we could bankrupt Iran. And Iran was in real trouble by the end of the Trump administration. They were not giving money and support to their proxy armies, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, Houthis,
sure.
name it. They were having a hard enough time feeding their own people. And they were probably within a couple of months of having to make some kind of a capitulation deal with the United States because they had no money. You know, we were bankrupting them. So if you could do that again, and I think it would happen very quickly in a different presidency, Iran is bankrupt. Iran can't afford to spend money on these wars. And the other countries in the Middle East, they want peace. Now, let me unpack that a little bit. So the countries in the Middle East, there's Israel. You have Iran, which is Shiite and Persian. And then you have the Gulf Arabs, the Sunnis. Now, the Gulf Arabs are the guys who export a lot of, you know, Saudi Arabia. They're all rich because of oil. But when they saw what was happening at the beginning of the Trump administration, that the United States was all of a sudden driving the price of oil from $120 a barrel to $40, $50 a barrel, the leaders of those countries, they said, yikes. We have a baby boom population we have to feed. 75% of our population is under the age of 35.
Right.
We can't count on oil revenues to power our societies. We got to make peace. We need investment. We need to diversify our economies. What do we do to do that? We need peace with Israel because nobody's going to invest in a Middle East which is at war. That was the crux of the Abraham Accords. And that's why the Sunni Arabs, who are not making much noise right now, they're kind of hunkering down, but they would be just as happy to see Iran dealt with in the way I just described.
We spoke with Rob Greenway from Heritage Foundation a few weeks ago.
He's so good, isn't he?
Yeah. He is, and you know, I highlighted his pivotal role in helping to kind of forge and construct the Abraham Accords.
Yeah.
And he provided insight, just as you have, as to the importance of those accords. They are grossly underplayed and neglected. President Trump and the rest of the staff that put that all together, you know, it's barely a footnote, but frankly, it's a dominant path out for what we're currently facing in the threats to Israel currently right now. And as you've described, a way to find a financial incentive to change the entire dynamic, the entire portrait of what's going on in the Middle East. How does Israel respond and react to what Biden's leaning on them with? I cannot see them saying, oh, okay, never mind, October 7th didn't happen, we're just going to let it go. So, I see a real confrontation here. This is going to be a tough moment for our relationship.
Yeah, and what's upsetting about it is that, I mean, why is President Biden doing this? Why is the Biden administration deciding to basically throw Israel under the bus? And that's because of voters in Michigan. So Biden knows that he doesn't win the state of Michigan unless he gets 20, 30, 40,000 Arab American voters. These are the guys, by the way, who are in the streets now chanting death to America, death to Israel,
right.
Kill all the Jews.
Right.
So they're determining American foreign policy because if Biden doesn't get their vote, he doesn't win Michigan. He doesn't win Michigan, he doesn't get reelected. So American foreign policy to one of our most staunch allies, Israel, is now being determined by the guys in the street screaming death to America. that's so flipped out on its head. It's just hard to even comprehend. But what the Biden administration is basically saying to Israel is, if you want our military support, which Israel needs, you know, weapons to be resupplied,
sure,
backfilled, if you want our intelligence cooperation, you've got to have an immediate ceasefire, and you got to go back. So Israel's in a position where it says, okay, we know that if we don't get rid of Hamas, Hamas comes back. Hamas comes back worse and harder than ever. The other thing that I find just so, sort of as an American citizen, just upsetting, is that President Biden, where are the American hostages? What, he's not even getting American hostages home. So he's doing all these things.
Any hostages, right? Any hostages, let alone
American, yes. How about our own people? How about getting them back?
Right.
So I think that they're walking away from Israel, and in their minds, that's going to help them win the election. But I think in their minds, they think, well, that's going to make peace more likely in the Middle East, right? Wrong. Because if Iran is sensing defeat of Israel, or sensing that they've driven a wedge between the United States and Israel, Iran's going in for the kill. You know, they have wanted to destroy the state of Israel for 45 years. And if they think that that relationship between the United States and Israel is drifting apart, that's when they're going to send Hezbollah, they're going to have the Houthis in Yemen. That's when they're already starting to resupply Hamas. That's when Israel is cornered and alone, and Iran goes in for the kill. And then what happens is, you know, the Israeli leaders, whether it's Bibi Netanyahu or any Israeli who's going to be in a leadership position in Israel right now, they all say, we've got to destroy Hamas. We're not going to let this happen again.
Yep.
So then if Israel's back is up against the wall, you know, who knows where this all goes?
The Biden administration has this incredible facility to subsidize absolutely everything that is the most destructive policy imaginable. I mean, it's shocking. Whether you look at unleashing billions of dollars of frozen assets to Iran, or whether it's leaning on the Israelis when they've suffered, you know, on a scale comparative to 9/11, this is outstrips 9/11 in the severity. And I mean, it scars the national psyche. You know, this is something for them that, you know, it's not an unfortunate incident. This is an existential threat. It's not something that can be sort of, you know, oh, well, we'll do better next time. There is no next time. And there's really a tone deafness that I think is quite stunning. And as you said, it really walks back to, you know, electoral district politics, right? How many counties in Michigan can be pushed one way or the other? And that's what's driving the Biden approach to this, is worrying about 2024 and, you know, the fourth Obama administration that they're so desperate to have. A good friend of mine personally, and somebody who obviously is a colleague of yours, of course, is General Mike Flynn. And he just came out with a movie about his life, trying to tell his side of the story. But in the days of really lawfare being launched against the Trump administration, what was really sort of a slow motion coup, in my estimation, it was an effort to destabilize the Trump administration, and all on manufactured fairy tales, stuff that was pure fiction. You know, Russia, and claims of, you know, people being assets, and just nonsense, stuff that was peddled by the likes of Adam Schiff and others for years. You also were targeted. You also were gone after and were subjected to pretty outrageous abuses by the Department of Justice, by congressional claims against you, Adam Schiff and others. You suffered at the hands of these people. I'd like you to just take a moment to talk about what you experienced and sort of the lessons that you take from being really unjustly, criminally, in my view, targeted the way that you were.
What happened was in the early days of the Trump administration, we now realize that it was the Justice Department, the FBI, the intelligence community, and the Justice Department deciding that they didn't want Donald Trump to win in 2016. So then they started these stories of, oh, Donald Trump, he's a Russian asset, Mike Flynn is Putin's puppet, et cetera, et cetera. And then when President Trump won, they really doubled down.
Right.
And they decided, well, we've got to sabotage his presidency because the American people aren't smart enough to elect the right person, right? So we've got to sabotage things. And that's when they cranked it up. And they knew, we now realize from documents that have come to light, that they weren't there at the time. You know, if people say, well, they should have investigated everybody, okay, but they knew they didn't have anything. They knew internally that Michael Flynn hadn't done anything wrong, that Donald Trump hadn't done anything wrong, that others, none of us had done anything wrong. That didn't stop them, because that's how they wanted to sabotage the Trump presidency.
Correct.
And the way they did it was, they knew, again, they had record, they knew he hadn't done anything wrong. And so they came knocking at my house. So see, behind me, this is my house. This is my front hall. That's my living room. They came knocking at my door. I'd already left the White House. I had been nominated to be ambassador to Singapore. And they knocked at my door, and I said, hi, who are you? I said, well, we're from the FBI, and we're here to see you. I thought, okay, well, maybe they're here to look at my security clearances because I've just been nominated to be ambassador to Singapore. So I, and this is the first lesson, you really should never let them in your house, like vampires. So I let them into my house, and then they said, we have just a couple of questions. We want to ask you about Russian interference in the election. And I said, good, because I don't want the Russians to interfere in our elections. I want to find out what they did and make sure they don't do it again. And so they said, okay, great. And so it was all very innocent. I mean, I had just come back from my exercise class. My husband had just left. I was all by myself in my smelly gym clothes. And I said, well, just a few little questions. We won't be here long. And so they started asking questions. And I said, look, I've not thought about this stuff in months. I have none of my records. I was a Girl Scout. I left all of my files and my devices and my diaries. I turned it over to government records. I don't have any of that. So I'm speaking off the top of my head. And I would qualify each sentence by saying, to the best of my recollection, or I'm not quite sure, but I think blah, 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 blah. And I said, we hadn't done anything wrong. And so they, when they finally left 6 hours later, I said, well, what happens now? And they said, we probably won't need to talk to you again. In the middle of that 6 hours, my husband came back and he called his law school best friend, Mike Mukasey, who had been the Attorney General of the United States. And he said, Mike, Casey's in here with some FBI agents in the other room. They're talking about Russia investigation. Do we need a legal presence right now with us? I mean, she hadn't done anything wrong. She didn't even talk to any Russians. And he said, nah, it's probably okay. They're probably just trying to establish the sort of parameters of what went on. Well, it turns out that's not what they were doing.
Yeah, no one in America would now draw that conclusion. Every person who has any sort of federal agent show up on their doorstep now should immediately contact their attorney.
Don't answer the door. Don't let them, like vampires, do not let them cross the threshold. Call a lawyer, any lawyer, and say, talk to my lawyer. I'm not talking to you directly. But what they realize in Mike Flynn's case and mine and others is they know I haven't done anything wrong. So they try to sort of catch you in two ways. One, they try to pretend that what you said that you don't remember correctly, or you said, I don't have any of my files to the best of, they try to say, well, you were lying.
Right.
You
right.
should have remembered that. That's a lie. That's perjury. And then when they couldn't get me on that, when I said, no, I'm not going to lie and say that I lied, I didn't lie. Then they realize they can bankrupt you because you need a lawyer and the lawyers are really expensive. I mean, I ended up spending $1 million to defend myself against crimes I did not commit, which they knew I did not commit. And that's the most pernicious of it all. They know that they'll go after good and decent people and they can bankrupt them. So what are they doing? They're basically saying, you want to go work for somebody we don't like Donald Trump? We're going to destroy you. We're going to stop your ability. We're going to end your ability to work again. We're going to wipe out your life savings. We are coming after you.
Right.
And that's the really... Just, I don't know how these people actually live with themselves when they do it, but that's how they target people.
Yep, the process is the punishment. That's the sad lesson. Yeah. The process is they want to grind you up in the administrative and the legal sort of double talk and gobbledygook. They'll never even get to any sort of a charge or any claim that you've done, but it's all manipulation and it's all, the process itself is what destroys people. Because they either go bankrupt or they have a nervous breakdown or the family split up. I mean, it is an incredibly high-pressure, destructive environment that they put on people. And they don't need to get a conviction because their objective is to destroy the person. That's what their objective is.
It's like right out of the Stalin playbook, right?
It is.
I mean, there was a point. It was really hard for me. I'm making fun of it now. But there was a point after, I don't know, 23 subpoenas and more and more meetings with the Mueller investigation where I turned to my husband and I said, should I just lie? and plead guilty to some kind of crime. I don't know what crime, but should I just do that and go away? Maybe I'll have my life back.
Yeah. They specialize in something. It's an old-fashioned word that doesn't get used very much, but they specialize in calumny, right? Calumny is the false swearing to destroy someone's reputation. And that's what they do. And they either do it officially by means of these FBI guys showing up and playing 20 questions with you, or their little friends in the media who write snide little smear-filled articles making allegations and claims that they never really quite have to explain or substantiate. And it's a pattern. I mean, this happens over and over and over again. And people that have served very honorably for decades and done put their life and soul into stuff, trying to do the right thing, and the intelligence and law enforcement apparatus, when they go after you, it is a life-changing event.
And you keep saying to yourself, well, this can't be happening in America. This is so unjust. And yet it is happening in America.
Yep.
And it's not just coming after me. It's going after Donald Trump and anybody they don't like. And so at a certain point, you kind of scratch your head and say, you know, maybe we really do need a big cleaning of house here, because these people in the administrative state, they can't be fired. They get automatic pay raises. They're faceless bureaucrats. And yet somehow they're in charge and they get to decide how the country's ruled, how governance is enforced, what laws we obey, what not. I mean, just the unbelievable hypocrisy of not going after the Hunter Biden for what was pretty obvious evidence, and yet at the same time going after anybody associated with President Trump and trying to put handcuffs on them.
Right.
So it's not just a two-tiered system of justice. I mean, to me, I've studied communism and Soviet systems since my grad school days at Oxford, and this is exactly the communist playbook. Destroy them. Destroy them. Destroy them however you can.
Yeah, it's all about power. That's what power drives everything for these people. KT McFarland, thank you so much for taking time with us. And before we close out, I just want to give you a last word. Where can folks follow what you're up to, what you're doing, what you're writing about, what you're posting on? What's a good place for our viewers and listeners to follow you?
Okay, so I'm on Twitter, and I'm on Twitter at Real KT McFarland. I have a website, a pretty active social media presence, and I do a lot of television, radio, advising, speeches around the country. So just pay attention. You'll hear me.
Very good. KT McFarland, thank you very much for your time today.
Honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Chris Farrell on Watch.
Thanks for listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.